From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Trumpeter Red Rodney saw his early life dramatized in Clint Eastwood's movie Bird. On today's Fresh Air, Red Rodney tells us what it was really like to play with Charlie Parker. Also, literary critic Dennis Donoghue describes growing up Catholic in a small town in Northern Ireland, where Catholics, he writes, were supposed to know their inferior place. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers the golden years of folk music and the magazine that cheered it on. And critic Maureen Corrigan tells us about one of her guilty pleasures. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Following a White House meeting with the president today, congressional leaders said that it's not time yet to call a special session to deal with the possibility of war in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Michael Richards reports.
Congressional leaders from both parties say they're satisfied with presidential assurances that the recent troop buildup doesn't indicate that a military strike is in the works. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Dante Fassell said the president indicated that any final decision on using force against Iraq will depend on how well sanctions and diplomatic efforts work.
With the assurance that no final decision has been made as of this moment with regard to use of force, and that the purpose is simply to keep the option open. And that is a responsible position, one that we find very credible.
And what this means for now is that the congressional leadership is on board and won't be summoning Congress back to Washington to debate the Gulf crisis, although that option, like many others in this crisis, remains open. I'm Michael Richards at the White House.
A leading Conservative Party opponent of British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher announced today that he'll challenge her for the leadership of the party. Michael Heseltine, a former member of Thatcher's cabinet, said he'll stand against her next Tuesday in a vote for control of the ruling Conservatives. If Heseltine wins, he'll automatically assume the post of Prime Minister. Thatcher has slipped in British opinion polls, and members of her own party have defected over her reluctance to unite with the European community. Former Deputy Prime Minister Geoffrey Howe attacked Thatcher yesterday in Parliament, saying her fears of European unity could leave Britain isolated. Iraq has added new conditions for an Arab summit proposed by Morocco's King Hassan. Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister said Arab states must scrap a resolution adopted by the Arab League supporting the multinational force in the Gulf. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Saudi Arabia.
Few Arab states have responded to the call by King Hassan. Iraq's new conditions puts the enterprise in further doubt. For the first time, Saudi Arabia has expressed an opinion about the summit. Prince Saud al-Faisal, the foreign minister, said today the summit would be a waste of time unless Iraq withdraws from Kuwait. Arab leaders have been consulting on the summit proposal. Today, Tunisia said it was sympathetic but gave no clear signal to attend. In the meantime, Iraq has returned to a hardline position after showing some flexibility following a visit to Baghdad by the Chinese foreign minister. In Riyadh, this is Deborah Amos.
Stock prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street, boosted by a drop in oil prices that came when President Bush told lawmakers that the Persian Gulf buildup didn't necessarily mean war. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 24 points to close at 2,559.65. Volume on the New York Exchange was 179 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is trumpeter Red Rodney. He went on the road when he was still a teenager and played in the bands of Claude Thornhill, Gene Krupa, and Woody Herman. In 1949, he ended up in the place just about every young jazz musician wanted to be, Charlie Parker's band. Parker hired him to replace Miles Davis. Here's Rodney with Parker's band from a 1951 recording of Swedish Schnapps.
Thank you.
After Red Rodney left Parker's band in the 1950s, his jazz career floundered, in part due to a drug habit, but he made a comeback in the 70s and has been going strong ever since. This year he was voted into the Downbeat Readers Hall of Fame, and he'll have a new record out early next year. Red Rodney is one of the musicians who was portrayed in the film Bird, Clint Eastwood's movie about Charlie Parker. Parker was played by Forrest Whitaker, Rodney by Michael Zellniger. In the movie, Rodney first meets Parker in an alley in back of a club.
Have we met?
No, sir. My name's Rodney.
You play Rodney?
Yeah, I'm with Krupa.
Do you play?
Trumpet.
Oh. And you came here to see Dizzy play.
I took the job touring with Krupa instead of staying in Philadelphia because the tour came to L.A. and I knew you were going to be here. Yeah, I came to hear you.
Now, a lot of people assume that they know you from having seen the movie Bird. How accurate a description of you was in the movie?
It was pretty accurate. Of course, some things they took licenses with. I didn't meet him in the back alley of Billy Berg's. I knew him 2 years before.
Parker, Charlie Parker.
Yeah. There was a hotel room scene which never happened. But aside from that, the wedding and the albino red bit in the South, that was true. The sort of friendliness that we had, he was sort of like an older brother. That was true. I think that came across. And I think the young man that portrayed me did very well.
Did you like the movie?
I was disappointed that they didn't show Charlie Parker like what he really did. It was a Charlie and Chan Parker. They made it a Hollywood love story, as they always do. Hollywood never gets it right. I think Clint Eastwood was given some bad advice and took it. I would have liked to have seen them show Charlie Parker as the great genius of modern music, modern jazz. And that could have been another Amadeus if they had done it that way.
Now, you started off playing in big bands. How did you first hear Bob and start playing it yourself?
Well, I had already been with a lot of the name bands because the war was on and all of the good trumpet players were drafted. And I was working in the house band of Atlantic City Steel Pier when all those bands came in, minus one or two trumpets. So they needed people like me. I got a little bit of experience there. Then I went with the Elliot Lawrence Orchestra, who was at WCAU, the radio station band. And that's when I first started listening to Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and hearing this whole new thing. And I was young enough to embrace it. I hadn't had any jazz history or traditions. My whole thing was Harry James and the big bands. And I remember Dizzy took me up to New York one Sunday, sat me in the middle of the Three Deuces and to hear his band. And I heard Charlie Parker. It was like a religious experience. I was completely overwhelmed. I remember leaving that place 4 o'clock in the morning and walking around like I didn't know what to do, where to go, how to think, but I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. That's how powerful that affected me.
Well, Charlie Parker eventually hired you to replace Miles Davis. Did you feel prepared for that?
Not really. No, I told him, too. I told him I really wasn't ready for that. And he said, well, let me be the judge of that. He said, I know a good trumpet player when I hear one, and I think you are ready, and you'll be more ready once you come. And, of course, I grabbed it. I often say that was like going to college and graduate school, the 3.5 years I played with him.
Did Parker take you under his wing in addition to taking you into his band?
Well, I don't know about that. We were very friendly, even before that. And, of course, we became more friendly when I was working for him. I was thrilled that a man like that could like me. I don't think I liked myself very much, but I was really thrilled that he did. And I guess you might say he took me under his wing a little bit, yeah. Of course, when he saw that I was trying to emulate him, he protested violently.
Emulate him in which way?
Well, in his drug use. And,
uh-huh.
he got very, very upset, and of course he didn't like it at all.
Do you think one of the reasons why he hired you is that you weren't using?
I don't think he thought of that. No, I don't think so. But I know it would have been, it would have been more difficult if I were. I don't think he would have wanted to be involved with that. It was enough for him rather than to have somebody else messing around like that.
Did you start using heroin as a way to emulate him? Is that what it was about?
Yes, I was very immature, and I kept looking and looking and saying, oh, my God, if I cross that line, could I possibly play like that? Curiosity killed the cat, you know, and pretty soon you wind up with a little habit. You don't play any better. In fact, you don't really live up to your potential because you have to be healthy to play well. And there it is. It took me years to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. What did Parker do to try to discourage you? Anything? Discourage you from using?
Well, many things. He threatened to fire me every day. he let me know, in no uncertain terms, how terrible a thing it was and how he couldn't handle it, what made me think that I could. Well, it turned out that it killed our greatest, or one of our greatest musical giants at the age of 34. And the young kid that was there, who was able to get straight, is now 63 years old and fairly successful. So there's the paradox.
Mm-hmm. Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. One of the celebrated stories in jazz lore is a story that was also recounted in the movie Bird. And that's the story of how during one of your tours through the South with Charlie Parker, he knew that an integrated band wouldn't go over well in the segregated South, that there were places you wouldn't be allowed to play. So he had the band advertised as Charlie Parker with albino red. So you were passed off as a black albino. This is a true story, right?
Yes, it is. We didn't fool anybody.
Uh-huh.
Everybody was very nice. And he had me sing a blues, and like the kid in the movie did. I think I sang better than that, though.
Is the story true that you ended up moving to a white hotel and Parker said, I'll come with you, you could call me your valet?
Yeah, and they didn't show that in the movie. They should have, because that was hilarious. It would have been much better than the story they put in there in a hotel where he asked me to kick him in his rear end, and that never happened.
So tell me the valet story.
Well, after about a week or 10 days, we were in Atlanta, and I saw this big, beautiful hotel, and I said, you know, I'm going to go check in there. I'm going to take a bath. I'm sorry, but I'm doing this. He says, that's a good idea, and I can go with you as your valet. And I thought he was crazy, but he knew the South. If any white man at that time would register and say, John Jones and valet, they would not question it, and they'd give the valet a room along with him. And that's what happened. I remember him trying to send me downstairs to get cigarettes and newspaper. I said, no, you got to go down. You're the valet.
Let me play something that you recorded with Parker. Let's hear Parker's composition, Blues for Alice. And would you like to say anything about your memories of this recording session?
Well, that particular session, I was playing in the Jewish Alps, the Catskill Mountains. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call. Well, I'm in the swimming pool, and he said, you better get down here quickly. Norman Granz is doing a record date with us, and told me the studio, and I said, I'll be right down. Well, it took three, four hours to get there. But I made it, and that was it. That was the Blues for Alice Swedish Schnapps date. I think it's called Swedish Schnapps, the album. At least originally it was.
Uh-huh. So this is Charlie Parker with Red Rodney on trumpet, John Lewis at the piano, Ray Brown on bass, Kenny Clark drums. My guest, Red Rodney on trumpet, and that recording of Blues for Alice, recorded with Charlie Parker and Red Rodney. Was it frustrating for you that during part of the period that you were with Parker, he was recording a lot of records with strings, which would mean that he wouldn't be recording featuring you in the small group?
Oh, it was quite frustrating. I remember I didn't know what I was going to do. I saw the handwriting on the wall that he was working more and more with strings. He tried to keep me on. It just wasn't enough money to have six or seven strings and another trumpet player. And I left and went back to Philadelphia and started working immediately. So that was okay.
What kind of work were you doing when you got back to Philadelphia?
Well, I did a lot of jazz work at first. You know, and then it wasn't so much happening at that time. So I started doing club dates, weddings, bar mitzvahs, and whatever.
That must have been very frustrating.
Very.
I mean, what kind of music would you have to play when you played bar mitzvahs?
Well, you played the standard tunes, and you played the pop tunes of the day, the Broadway show tunes. It was very good for you. Today, I go to a lot of affairs because my wife's in business, and there's a lot of affairs in that particular business. I see young jazz musicians playing in those bands, and so they make it sound much better. When I played in them, they were very corny, very society-oriented, the two-beat step, the two-step dancing with your elbows, you know, the Lester Lanninmeyer Davis type.
Mm-hmm.
But it did teach me a lot, and it gave me a big repertoire for standard tunes. So you learn whatever you do, really.
Do you get a lot of use out of Hava Nagila?
Oh, yeah, but that's only the commercial one. There's a lot of other inside ones that are very good.
Uh-huh.
And when I played concerts in Israel, they flipped out that I knew all that music over there.
Oh, really?
Sure, because I knew the real valid Hebrew music. I knew the Hasidic music. I knew the Romanian music. And they freaked out that a jazz artist would know all of that.
Huh. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is trumpeter Red Rodney. This is Fresh Air. Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. You were telling us before that one of the reasons why you started using heroin was in the hopes that you'd play better, like Parker, who was a user, played so well, but that it didn't help your music, and as a matter of fact, it hurt your music and got you further away from it. You did this incredible scam to make money to support your habit, and I think this was in the 1950s where you impersonated a general and forged army checks.
Well, I did a lot of incredible things. I was a very good improviser. But you know something? To relate to that today mm-hmm. is like I've become a virgin with white gloves. I can't even relate to that same person. Yeah, you know, a lot of the junkies in my day went out and they stole. The musicians that were junkies stole other guys' horns and this and that. I figured that if I were going to have to do that, I would either beat the banks or beat the government. So I did, and I paid for it. And I came out a much better person. That's all long behind me, you know, and I'm not going to discuss that because it's coming out in a book very soon, and Clint Eastwood might make a movie out of it, so
oh,
we
really?
Won't discuss that here.
Has he been talking to you about making a movie about your life?
Well, he's been talking to me about taking a first option on this book and the screenplay that we're almost finished with right now.
And the book is what, an autobiography?
Yeah.
Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. You spent a good part of the 1960s in showbiz, playing in Vegas bands. Why did you end up leaving jazz and going to Vegas?
Well, I had children. I was straightening my life out.
Mm-hmm.
And Vegas, you made a good living. You played in the hotel showroom orchestras. You worked 3 hours a day, and you made $600-$800 a week, which is a very good salary, especially for then. The only unfortunate thing is there's no jazz at all. It was strictly showbiz. And eventually my jazz roots had to catch up to me. When my kids grew and left and went out on their own, I came right back to New York and came right back into jazz. And I've been very happy ever since.
What kind of shows did you play for in Vegas?
Well, I worked in the Flamingo for many years, and then the Hilton. I played Frank Sinatra. I played Tom Jones. I played so many. A lot of the big-name stars. I played French Reviews at another hotel there. And all things that you really don't like doing. But the living out there is very good if you're not a gambler. Living in the desert was beautiful. It's a nice place to retire to, really. It's very inexpensive. The taxes are very low. However, there's no jazz. And there probably never will be when, you know, the people that go there for the gambling and a big extravaganza, the Hollywood-type shows. These people listen to music with their feet instead of their ears.
When you decided to go back to New York and get back into jazz, how did you start?
I went with George Wein. He called me, and it was 1974, and took me to Europe on a tribute to Charlie Parker, the musical life of Charlie Parker. I did that tour. When that tour was finished, I stayed there and lived in Copenhagen for about almost 2 years. I lived in Copenhagen, but I worked all over Europe, and that got me back into the jazz market. And living in Copenhagen was very nice. And, of course, there's lots of work in Europe for an American jazz musician of some standing. However, I no longer had to be away from America, and I missed it terribly. I really wanted to come back. This is my home, and I love it. So I just picked up and came home.
You had some dental problems, I think, when you were getting back into jazz.
Yes, indeed.
Now, I think that this dates back to having your two front teeth knocked out by a cop. Is that right?
Yes, in Philadelphia, 1952. That started it.
What happened? What was the story?
Oh, nothing. A guy came to examine me, so he said.
What do you mean?
Well, back then, if they caught somebody who was using drugs, they didn't have to catch him dirty. All they had to do was look at his arms and see if he had recent marks. Unconstitutional. Against all civil liberties. And that was it. Now he placed me under arrest, and I didn't say a word. And he started beating the crap out of me. You know? You know, of course, he tried to say, oh, well, he tried to fight me back. Now, how's a little guy like me going to stand up to a big 6'3" or 6'4" animal? And that's what he was.
Was he trying to arrest you for using?
Yeah. Years later, he got arrested for selling drugs, too.
No kidding,
very
really?
Nice to know.
Huh.
Yeah. Many years later.
Was it hard for you to start playing jazz again? I mean, did you have to get back in the swing of things?
You have to get back a little bit, sure. You just can't pick up your horn and start doing it. That period in Europe was very good for me because I was working quite a bit. I was getting all my thoughts together. And when I got back to America, I was in good shape. I was better than I had ever been. In fact, my best years musically have been between the ages of 50 and 62. So I'm very lucky. Most men, in anything they do, when they reach 50, they start slipping a bit. I seem to have been shooting up and improving. I hope it continues for another 10 years or 20 years.
So do you do anything really mischievous anymore? I mean,
I told you, my wife calls me a virgin with white gloves.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm a very conservative, normal, straight-living person today. That's the way it should be. You know, after I straightened my life out, the jazz profession is very, very forgiving. As long as you can play, and as long as they see that you're okay, you're welcomed back like nothing ever happened. So I've been very lucky. And I would hope that the other people who straighten up become as lucky as I did.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Trumpeter Red Rodney, he has a new album due out in January, and he'll be performing at the Village Vanguard in New York the week of December 4th. Next time, the Rolling Stones bassist, Bill Wyman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's music from a recent Red Rodney album called Red Snapper. This one's called For You. It was written by the band's pianist, Gary Dial. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When literary critic Dennis Donahue was a boy, his family shopped at the Catholic grocery, bought meat from the Catholic butcher, and had only Catholic friends. Life divided across religious lines in his hometown, where Protestants had the power. Coming up, Dennis Donahue on religion, Yeats, and lost opportunities in Northern Ireland. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the heyday of the protest song, the protest singers, and the magazine that spurred them on. And commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us why, time after time, she falls for the horse racing stories of Dick Francis. He's just published his 29th, Long Shot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Members of Congress met with President Bush today at the White House and were briefed by Secretary of State James Baker. Although the entire Congress will not be returning to Washington for a special session, several hearings will be held to more clearly define U.S. military policy in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
This morning, Republican leaders emerged from the White House after meeting with the president, saying there's strong bipartisan support for the administration's policy in the Gulf, and there are no longer questions about the overall mission, despite the recent troop buildup. But after closed-door sessions with Secretary of State James Baker and Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, indications of what's been termed an erosion of support began to surface. Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy says the mission is confused and that the president is plunging this country headfirst into war.
Clearly, this administration is set upon a path which means, I believe, armed conflict in the Persian Gulf.
Kennedy said he received no assurances that the president would first seek the authorization of the Congress. Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Dante Fassell, said when the president was asked about this, his response was to pull out a copy of the Constitution and read aloud from it that he was the commander-in-chief. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
In the Middle East, the Israeli army has imposed a curfew in most of the occupied territories on the eve of the second anniversary of the declaration of a Palestinian state. The Israelis said the increased military security was also meant to prevent any protest over the jailing without trial of three Palestinian leaders in the occupied territories. Alex Brody of the BBC has more.
Prominent Palestinians accuse the Israeli authorities of acting unjustly, without evidence, and out of a desire to repress by jailing the three men without trial. At a press conference in East Jerusalem, the men, two journalists and a doctor, were described as proponents of nonviolence and a political solution. University professor Hanan Ashrawi said the Israelis were signaling that voices calling for peace were no longer going to be listened to. This was the result of pressure from the extreme right wing of the most right-wing government in Israel's history. Tomorrow, Thursday, is the second anniversary of the declaration by the Palestinian Parliament in exile of a Palestinian state. Curfews have been imposed on towns, villages, and refugee camps throughout the occupied territories. Roadblocks are up already. It's estimated that 1 million Palestinians have been confined to their homes.
Alex Brody reporting for the BBC. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 24 points to close at 2,559.56 on volume of 179 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, Maureen Corrigan reviews the latest mystery by writer Dick Francis. In the mid-60s, Bob Dylan was probably the best known of the protest singers, but rock and roll historian Ed Ward says there were several other singer-songwriters who were reacting to the times, and one of the forums they had wasn't a coffee house, it was a small publication.
My first published work, if you can call it that, appeared in a New York-based mimeograph magazine published by a husband and wife team of old-line lefties. Sis and Gordon Cunningham had edited Broadside, as it was called, out of their Upper West Side apartment since February 1962, with an aim that was as old as Joe Hill, to give America's protesters good songs to sing and get them out quickly. Since these were the days of the folk revival and the civil rights movement, Sis and Gordon were in the right place at the right time. Their sixth issue featured on its cover a song that was making the rounds of the Hootenannies, Blowin' in the Wind, by the exciting newcomer Bob Dylan. He even did some of his first recording for a collection of Broadside songs in 1963, using the familiar pseudonym Blind Boy Grunt.
John Brown went off to war to fight on a foreign shore. His mother sure is proud of him. He stood so straight and tall in his uniform and all. His mother's face broke out all in a grin.
But after Dylan's discovery, he kept fairly aloof from the Broadside crowd, and the magazine had to depend on the dozens of songwriters and performers who followed in his wake.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British Wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a-marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a-marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
Phil Oakes was perhaps the brightest star of them all. He was an accomplished guitarist with a real sense of melody, so he didn't have to steal traditional tunes like Dylan did. Oakes was a former journalism student from Ohio whose anger could be a little too evident.
Here's to the state of Mississippi. For underneath her borders, the devil draws no line. If you drag her muddy rivers, nameless bodies you will find. Oh, the fat trees of the forest have hid a thousand crimes. The calendar is lying when it reads the present time. Oh, here's to the land you've torn out the heart of. Mississippi, find yourself another country to be part of.
Oakes wrote a lot of songs like that one, and in fact changed that one to Here's to the State of Richard Nixon after a while. It was only a slight improvement. One thing Broadside liked to do was emphasize causes that weren't in the headlines. The civil rights movement was doing fine, reviving old hymns like We Shall Overcome and We Shall Not Be Moved. So, somewhat strangely for a New York-based movement, suddenly we were hearing from American Indians.
Now the Senecas are an Indian tribe of the Iroquois Nation. Down on the New York-Pennsylvania line, you'll find their reservation. After the U.S. Revolution, Corn Planter was a chief. He told the tribe these men they could trust. That was his true belief.
Peter Lafarge was the adopted Native American son of novelist Oliver Lafarge. Unfortunately, as you can hear, he couldn't sing, so others did his songs.
Call him Drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not that whiskey-drinking Indian or the Marine that went to war. Come gather round me, people, and a story I will tell about a brave young Indian you should remember well, from a tribe of Pima Indians, a proud and peaceful band that farmed the Phoenix Valley in the Arizona land.
Patrick Skye was half Indian, half Irish, and all charismatic. And he introduced the crowd to Buffy St. Marie, who was soon to become an even bigger star than Pat ever was. There were others. Mark Spolstra, a 12-string guitar virtuoso and conscientious objector. Malvina Reynolds, a grandmother and an ex-communist who became well-known for Little Boxes, a song about suburban conformity. Tom Paxton, who was too gentle to be effective. Janice Fink, a nice 13-year-old Jewish girl from Long Island who wrote a song about interracial dating, society's child. They all gathered once a month at the village gate for the monthly broadside hootenannies, singing, as the saying has it, to the choir. In 1966, I paid my last visit to Broadside with a girl I knew from college who was pretty ahead of the time, an early flower child. Sis and Gordon welcomed us, but Gordon was depressed. "I don't know what Bobby thinks he's doing," he said, referring to Dylan. "I wish he'd sit down and write a good song about the war." "But Gordon," my friend said, wide-eyed, "they're all about the war." Gordon had a point, though. The Broadside crowd was writing love songs by then, and he wanted an anthem. But a new day was dawning out west, and in a special talking issue of Berkeley's Rag Baby magazine, Joe McDonald finally provided one.
"Well, come on, all of you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next up is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. Come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Why, man, this war a go-go. There's plenty good money to be made by supplying the army with the tools of his trade. But just hope and pray that if they drop the bomb, they drop it on..."
That's the Fixin' to Die Rag. Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Literary critic Dennis Donoghue grew up Catholic in Northern Ireland. His father was one of the few Catholic policemen in the Protestant-dominated police force of Northern Ireland, the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Donoghue went to college in Dublin and taught at Cambridge University in England before coming to this country, where he teaches part of each year at New York University. He's written many books of literary criticism, but now for the first time, Donoghue has written about his own life. His memoir is called Warren Point, which is the name of the town he grew up in.
The population of Warren Point was about 2,000 in my time, 1,000 Catholics, 1,000 Protestants. There was no enmity between them. It was necessary only to keep your distance. My father, not given to phrase-making, told me once that my dealings with other people should be civil but strange. Power, such as it was in the hands of the Protestants. That was all a Catholic needed to know. My father, a splendid policeman, could not be promoted. He was not a Protestant. Therefore, he was not a Unionist. Therefore, he was not a member of the Loyal Order of Orange Men. Therefore, the ability to tell a Protestant from a Catholic in Warren Point is not a skill I'm proud of, but it was a social necessity in those years. Necessary more than ever now. It was prudent to look at a man or woman, boy or girl, before leaping to the notion that you could speak. Names were a help, but were not decisive. Dr. O'Tierney was a Catholic, Dr. Glennie a Protestant. Newell and Chu were Protestant names. O'Neill, the family owned the Crown Hotel, now long gone, bombed, a Catholic name. But the telling detail was the first, or Christian name. Isabel, as I knew to my cost and pain, was a Protestant name. Dennis, Timothy, Kathleen, and Mary couldn't be anything but Catholic. Patrick was an awkward case because at a certain level of social standing and grandeur, it was a common name among Protestants. At a lower level, it was standard Catholic.
Dennis Donoghue, your father decided to move north after the Government of Ireland Act of 1921, which divided Ireland. Why did he want to move?
Well, he didn't at all want to move. All of his life had been spent in the south of Ireland. He was a member of what we call the RIC, that's the Royal Irish Constabulary, which in effect is the police as it was under the British days, before Ireland became a self-governing nation. And he certainly, I wouldn't say he was happy at that, but he certainly wasn't sufficiently educated to do anything else. But one of the provisions of the treaty, which separated the north of Ireland from the south, was that if you held a public job, an official public job such as a policeman in the south of Ireland, you had the right to go north and take up the same job at the same rank. Now, my father spent about 6 months trying to find a job elsewhere. Indeed, he made his one visit to England to try to find a job and couldn't. And only after about 6 months did he come back and go to the north of Ireland and claim his right to be a policeman. So that's how he came to be there. Up to that point, the family had no connections whatever with the north of Ireland.
Was your father in the position of having to uphold laws that he didn't believe in?
Well, I don't think he ever raised that question. He interpreted the laws as he saw them in a perfectly orthodox way, and he certainly didn't feel any personal loyalty either to the King of England or indeed to the British Empire, of which he was a part. But he subsumed all of that. He accommodated all of those feelings within his own silence and his own quiet authority.
What did you think of Protestants when you were growing up?
Well, I was very edgy towards them. And you see, in a town like Warren Point, it was impossible to know any Protestants. You were aware that they were there and you passed them on the street. But you didn't enter into conversation with Protestants if you were a Catholic, and of course with Catholics if you were a Protestant. So that we were quite simply divided, not divided in hostility, but divided through temperament. It was almost it was so fundamental. It was almost a primordial instinct that if you were a Catholic, you recognized Catholics, and you recognized Protestants as being different. But there was no question. We didn't feel that if we saw a Protestant, we should beat them. There was no question of that. But we simply lived totally separate lives. We conducted our social life separately. Our schooling was separate. Every activity was separate. We even sat, in a sense, when we were going to school in Newry on the bus. We would sit in one part of the bus, and the Protestant girls, there was a Protestant girls' school in Newry, and they would sit at a different part of the bus.
You were a student at the school of the Christian Brothers Abbey, and you read that the Christian Brothers didn't encourage the students to become rebels, but they recognized that a Catholic growing up in the North must live by a certain stratagem, spiritual secrecy.
Well, there was a sense in, we knew, we were, first of all, we were a Catholic school. We were a Catholic school and living and working under a system which was predominantly Protestant. So we had to mind our P's and Q's, as they say. We had to know what we were doing. We went through all the motions of observation, but we were aware that we were different. There were Protestant schools also in Newry, and we were aware that we differed from them, and that we marched to a different drum, as it were. We had a different notion of Irish history. We told different stories. We thought of Ireland in quite different ways, and so on. And so, yes, I think secrecy is the sense. There was a kind of kinship, almost spontaneous and intuitive.
How did the sense of having different stories from the Protestants and having the sense of secrecy affect your influence in Irish literature? And you've written extensively about Irish literature over the years.
Well, most of modern Irish literature has been written by Protestants. And indeed by, say, the greatest of that line is W.B. Yeats. And Yeats was a Protestant by affiliation. He wasn't a great believer in any form of Christianity, but certainly by tradition, by family inheritance and so on, he was a Protestant. And he took a very lofty attitude, indeed, towards Catholics, by and large. He detested the new kind of power that was developing in the country. He knew that in his lifetime, power in the south of Ireland was indeed being handed over more and more to middle-class Irish Catholics. And he detested such people as classes. As a class, I don't mean that he detested individual Catholics.
Has the fact that Yeats was Protestant put a distance between you and he in your appreciation of his work?
Well, you know, you have to make a kind of leap of imagination, but I've always believed that the real function, the purpose and the dignity of literature is that it provokes you to imagine lives other than your own, ways of being, ways of feeling quite different from your own. It seems to me that that's the whole point of literature. There would be no good reason for its existing If it were required merely to endorse your own feeling or to express your own structure of interests. So the crucial challenge of literature is that we're meant to confront and to engage and to sympathize with lives quite different from our own. Now, in that sense, I have to make, as a predominantly lower middle class Irish Roman Catholic in my background, I have to make a kind of leap of imagination. I have to try to imagine what Yeats is talking about when he's speaking about these high aristocratic virtues, which he sometimes finds among Italian 15th and 16th century princes, and sometimes he finds them among the barons of 18th century Anglo-Ireland. So, but it's intrinsically no different from imagining what it would be like to be Macbeth or Hamlet or Coriolanus. You know, what is it like to want to murder a king? You just have to imagine, or you're provoked into imagining, what that would be like.
Much of your memoir, Warren Point, is about your father, and you write about him that he believed in rules. Speech was not his medium. He never read a novel, never went to a concert or a film or a play. It's interesting to think about how you became so involved with books yourself.
Well, I sometimes think I don't really understand that myself. It is true that my father was, in fact, in my view, a notable and distinctive person. But his significance, in a strange way, was almost physical. That is, that The virtues he had were not virtues he proclaimed, but virtues in some curious way that he embodied. It was not that he ever said anything of any real significance, but he seemed somehow in his very movement, in the way in which he walked along the street. Now, this may have had something to do with his carriage, his bearing, his uniform, for example, but he seemed somehow to embody in this marvelously silent way virtues which other people would have to argue into existence. There was a sense in which he never had to argue anything. Now, admittedly, he had his vices. He was very inflexible. He lived in certain respects like a railway schedule. But at the same time, what I revere in him is that sense somehow of a wonderful kind of rectitude which doesn't need to have to claim anything for itself. It's somehow there. It's demonstrably there. If you saw my father walking along the street, he held himself erect, and there was a kind of nobility of stance about him. And he was a man of utter integrity. But again, it was an integrity that never had to define itself. It simply was there.
This is probably the opposite about the way you feel about yourself, right?
Well, I don't think many of my virtues get established in the way in which I walk or anything. I think I have to argue myself either into virtues or even into the consideration of them. I don't feel I coincide with myself in the way that my father, I feel, coincided with himself. There's a kind of unity of bearing and being which my father had, which certainly I don't feel I've ever had.
Well, Dennis Donahue, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Dennis Donahue's new memoir is called Warren Point. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, today we'll have news of President Bush's briefing of the Congress about the Persian Gulf. Also, the case for lengthening the school year. A Massachusetts state legislator says that the United States has brought its mythology, its complacency, and its defensiveness to bear in the argument against having a longer school year. A report also from Renee Montaigne on the competition between two black political movements in one South African village. And we'll also hear about the strange politics of Providence, Rhode Island, where the former mayor has been reelected, but there's a challenge to his taking office.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Dick Francis is one of the most prolific contemporary mystery writers, with bestsellers like Photo Finish and Reflex. But before he started this career, he worked as a jockey for the British royal family. His novels involve horse racing, and critic Maureen Carrigan says there's also evidence of his brush with the Windsors.
I'd like to announce a new literary award, the Gertrude Stein Memorial, A Rose is a Rose is a Rose Prize. To be eligible, all a writer has to do is to repeat the same dialogue or scene in three consecutive books. The first prize is going to Dick Francis for managing to write the same horse racing scene into all 29 of his mysteries. Here's the obligatory race with a close finish from his newest book, Long Shot. The horse, this time, is called Chickweed. The jockey's name is Nolan. Nolan, aggressive instincts in full flood, was crouching like a demon over Chickweed's withers, delivering the message that losing was unacceptable. Chickweed, as if galvanized, took up the struggle again. The jockey and horse in front, judging the battle won, eased up fractionally too soon. Chickweed caught them napping, astride from the winning post, and put his head in front, just where it mattered. The crowd cheering for him, the favorite, the fighter who never gave up. You got it? Dick Francis recycles this scene to establish the moral code of his books. It goes something like this. Racing is like life. Cowards and cheaters always lose. The good and the brave always win, no matter how dismal the odds. I don't buy this meritocratic drivel, but I'm a staunch Dick Francis fan. His books are suspenseful and fun, even if his politics are archaic. Francis is one of my guilty pleasures, and given his attitudes towards class and gender, I have a lot to feel guilty about. The typical Dick Francis mystery restores order to the racing world by restoring power to the aristocracy. Usually, a humble but fearless hero, often a jockey, discovers an evil plot against racing. He informs one of the patrician members of the Racing Commission, someone with a name like Sir Nigel Gout. At first, Sir Nigel's judgment is clouded, maybe by the gallons of gin and tonics he's guzzled over the years. But Sir Nigel always rallies, the wicked bounder is arrested, and our hero rides off, usually with Sir Nigel's niece. This brings me to Dick Francis's sexual politics, which are even more reactionary than his faith in benevolent despots. To Francis, a desirable woman is a lot like a racehorse. Both have good bloodlines, glossy manes, and nimble forelocks. And both secretly want to be reined in and mastered by men. Probably the worst Dick Francis mystery in terms of women is a book called Forfeit, published in 1969. The hero is a sports writer, married to a woman who is stricken by polio, and she's now completely paralyzed. After the usual plot against racing has been foiled, the hero's wife tells him that, given the circumstances, it's okay if he wants to take an occasional extramarital role in the hay. The woman may be in an iron lung, but she's a topping good sport about it. Longshot doesn't have any romantic subplots. Maybe Francis decided that it's safer for him to stick to horses. But everything else about this book is pretty much the same as his other books. One of the pleasures of good formula fiction is that it thrills and offends you in predictable ways time after time.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Dick Francis's new novel is Longshot. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy and Seuss Bolin. Roberta Sherrock directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the Rolling Stone who doesn't move around on stage and never did a lot of drugs, bassist Bill Wyman. Also, Michael Cunningham on his new novel, A Home at the End of the World. It's about being somewhere between gay and straight, looking for an alternative family. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.